This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, welcome to another edition of The Bunker, daily news and politics for the busy podcast aficionado. I'm Andrew Harrison. 40 years ago this year, Britain was convulsed by the last great industrial confrontation of the trade union era, the miners' strike of 1984 to 1985, when three quarters of Britain's 180,000 miners fought the Thatcher government plans to close down 20 pits. Vastly politically significant, the strike generated appalling hardship in pit communities and scenes of violence that were almost impossible to believe on British soil, particularly the notorious Battle of Orgreave, where 6,000 police with dogs and horses attacked pickets with a brutality that was unprecedented in modern times. At the centre of it all were two of the most uncompromising individuals ever to take a major role in British political life: the National Union of Mine Workers hardline socialist president Arthur Scargill and Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Both saw the strike as nothing less than a struggle for the fate of the country, and neither would give an inch. In the end, the miners were defeated, effectively ending mass union power in the UK and paving the way for further privatisations, including steel, railways, gas, telecoms and water. The strike entered the mythology of the Labour left as a story of state cruelty and betrayal from within Neil Kinnock's Labour Party. But what did it really mean? Do we remember the miners' strike correctly, or have we remade it to serve our current ideas? Robert Kildare is Emeritus Professor of Modern History at Oxford. Among his vast body of work over the past 40 years is an oral history project where he interviewed former miners, miners' wives and the children about the strike. Professor Kildare, welcome to The Bunker.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for joining us. Why has the strike assumed such a kind of mythical role in British political memory? You know, it is, like I said, the last great big visible confrontation on British soil.
Well, because on the one hand, the coal industry was always going to close. I mean, if you think that there were a million miners in Britain at the time of the First World War and, you know, about 200,000 miners at the time of the strike, and oil and gas were coming in, nuclear power was coming in. And so in a sense, the coal industry was always going to be phased out at some point. But in fact, there'd been a fillip because of the oil crisis of 1973. Coal was in demand. And there was actually a young generation of miners who came into the pits who were quite political. The impact of the miners' strike came to him the day Mrs. Thatcher died in 2013, and everyone was coming onto the radio saying what a wonderful person she was. Even the people who'd stabbed her in the back and ousted her from power were saying what a wonderful person she was. The only people who were saying that she was a nasty piece of work and had ruined the country and had ruined their lives were the miners. And I thought, well, there's a very interesting story there. Thatcher wanted to have revenge for what happened to the Tories in 1974 when there was a miners' strike and Edward Heath went to the country with the question, who rules Britain? And the answer came back, not you, mate. And the Tories were desperate to have revenge on the miners for the humiliation of 1974. And as you said, they also had a programme of privatisation of nationalised industries, and the mining industry was front and centre there. And so even before they came to power in 1979 or returned to power, they had a Ridley plan, the plan which bears the name of Nicholas Ridley, which was a plan to privatise industry and to be ready in case of a substantial miners' strike in resistance to what they were doing. So the government was ready with anti-trade union legislation, with stockpiling of coal, with plans to cut benefits to mining families. And of course, they trained and equipped and centralised the police force in order to deal with the strike. And on the other hand, the miners, who were ready for a confrontation, had elected Arthur Scargill NUM president in 1982. I think he got 70% of the vote. And he was an immensely popular leader. And he was the man who said, well, you know, the government does have this secret plan to close 20 pits, if not more. It's going to cost tens of thousands of jobs, and we have to fight back. And so, you know, there was this gigantic clash because, as I say, the mines would have closed anyway, but it was a political struggle that triggered the whole thing off.
So the NUM's stated aim was to save the pits, but the way it was kind of reported and discussed around the country was that they were intent on bringing down the government. Is there truth to that, or is that just my granddad's Daily Express talking there?
I mean, I don't think they wanted to bring down the government. Clearly, they wanted to defeat the government. That was something else. They wanted to get the government to withdraw its plan for pit closures and to invest in the coal industry. I mean, the Labour government in the 1970s had a plan for coal. And as I said, coal was not finished. And because of the oil crisis, there was still a demand for coal. And I suppose the other thing was that what the miners were doing, they were defending their union, which was a very powerful union, which had been used to negotiating with governments. But they were also, as you say, they were defending their communities, because the previous strike in 72 and 74 had really been about wages, about making sure that the miners' wages kept up with the wages of other industrial workers. But by the time you got to 84, they really were about pit closures. The miners and their supporters and their families invented this slogan, close a pit, kill a community. And they knew that if the pits closed in substantial numbers, communities would be hit because schools would close, post offices would close, shops and businesses would close, leisure facilities would close, and there would be devastation across mining communities, which of course is what happened in the long term, or in the next 10 years after the strike happened.
The Achilles heel of the strike seemed to be that there hadn't been a full national ballot in which it was clear that every miner in the country, or at least a democratic majority of miners in the country, supported the action. Scargill became a villain in the Conservative press, but even Labour voters found him hard to support without that kind of clear mandate. And I found something that Roy Hattersley wrote on the 20th anniversary of the strike, saying that almost all that Scargill did, from the timing of the strike to his public appearances, might have been planned by government strategists. Was there a kind of a degree to which Scargill was, you know, perhaps the miner's own worst enemy, a leader full of passionate intensity but on shaky ground?
Well, the truth is there had been a number of ballots over the years. And of course, one of the problems was that at the time of the strike, they needed a 55% majority for a national strike. And there'd been previous occasions when they hadn't got that. And in particular, mining communities like Nottinghamshire had only ever voted for about, you know, 20 or 30% of those miners wanted to strike. And in fact, there were actually two legal routes to a strike under the NUM rulebook. One was a national ballot. The other one was, but if a strike broke out in a local coalfield, it could be endorsed by the National Executive Committee of the Miners' Union, and that would be an official strike. And that was, in fact, how the strike did break out, because strikes broke out in Yorkshire, in County Durham, in South Wales, in Scotland, in Kent. And in all those areas, these strikes were properly endorsed by the NUM. There was also a conference in Sheffield several weeks into the strike where delegates from all the pits debated whether they should have a national ballot. And they decided that they were already 80% out. And the main thing was to have solidarity with their comrades, and they didn't need a national ballot. But you are right that it was because there was the option of a national ballot, this was always held like a sword of Damocles. And of course, the Nottinghamshire miners who didn't want to come out on strike, their line was, well, if you have a national ballot, you know, we promise that if it's a majority, we'll come out on strike. But historically, when there were ballots, the Nottinghamshire miners had not come on strike. And in fact, just shortly after the outbreak of the strike, there was a ballot in Nottinghamshire, which, if I remember rightly, voted 73.5% not to strike. So, as I say, there were two options. The national ballot was an option. It wasn't the only option, but because it was an option, it was always held over the miners as something they hadn't done.
My memory of the time, again, is a kind of paralysed silence from the Labour Party, which kind of has its echoes now when we see a lot of calls from trade union members and the Labour left for the Labour leadership to come out and support strikes, and it doesn't. This was a huge part of the miners' strike, wasn't it? Where did this leave Neil Kinnock's Labour Party, which was still trying to reconstruct itself after 1983 and trying to regain its credibility in front of Middle Britain?
I mean, the Labour Party is the Labour Party. The Labour Party emerged, you know, around about 1900 out of the trade union movement. It was the kind of political wing of the trade union movement. But I suppose the tension in the heart of the Labour Party has been, you know, do we represent the trade union workers, the trade union movement, and the working class, or are we a much broader political party who represents other people. And of course, and of course, the Labour Party always had to deal with the media. And the media during the strike was completely behind the Thatcher government. All the talk about the enemy within, you know, the lack of a national ballot, the fact that Arthur Scargill was compared to a Nazi leader from time to time. The temper of the country, because of the government and the media, was very much against the strikers, which meant that this put the Labour Party and the Labour leadership in a very difficult position. I mean, some of the Labour Party were obviously behind the strike, the left wing of the party, but obviously you cited Roy Hattersley. Kinnock was accused by the miners of South Wales of sitting on the fence so much that he had splinters in his backside. So, you know, the miners found Kinnock very frustrating, and they also found the trade union leadership very frustrating. I mean, one of the problems with the strike is that they didn't get support from other industries, like the steel industry, or they got some support from the railway workers, but the dock workers, the steel workers, and so on did not support them. And that was partly because of anti-union legislation, which prevented secondary pickets and sympathy strikes, so that the miners were left very isolated.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
The strike is remembered as a kind of an episode of betrayal in what we talked about there, that the Labour left considers it that the miners were effectively left high and dry by the leadership. And there's also a sense of heroic failure, that this was a kind of a doomed crusade. Was the strike doomed to fail from the start? You've already outlined the preparations that the government had made, but was it fundamentally flawed in that it was not possible to keep uneconomic pits open forever, no matter how much money they might be losing and so on?
I think what might have been possible was a negotiated settlement. For example, in South Wales, there was great pressure from the trade union movement and indeed the churches in South Wales, who came together to try to organise a negotiated settlement. And at times, I think Ian McGregor, who was in charge of the coal board, and Mrs. Thatcher, they kind of faltered. But at the end of the day, the Thatcher government was determined to get sort of unconditional surrender from the miners. They wanted to break the NUM, and then that would lead the way to breaking other trade unions. And indeed, the trade union movement in the country was severely weakened as a result of this. So, the government had on its power the media, the police. It also had the courts. And one of the things we haven't mentioned is that large numbers of miners, you know, were arrested for being on picket lines. And increasingly towards the end of the strike, if you were arrested on a picket line, you were very likely to lose your job. You'd get a letter of dismissal from the coal board within hours sometimes of being arrested and taken to court. So the power of the press, the police, the courts was against the miners. And in a sense, what was extraordinary was that the miners and their communities and their families kept going for a whole year. And one thing that we haven't mentioned is the role of women, is the role of miners' wives in this, because within weeks of the strike, people could see that it was going to be lasting for a long time. And support groups were set up, which were dominated by miners' wives, which were raising funds to set up soup kitchens, to organize food parcels to all striking miners' families. And some people have described this as an alternative welfare state that was set up, because the government, again, was the only benefits that were coming through to miners were child benefits. All other benefits were shut down. If you went on a picket line, you got paid a pound a day or £2 a day. But these were people who had to fall back on their own resources. And again, there was a huge fundraising exercise. Miners were coming to London or going to Glasgow or Liverpool or going to Ireland or across to Europe. There were huge links made with trade unions in Europe and cities in Europe, which funded the miners' strike and which sent over turkeys and Christmas trees and money for Christmas of 1984. So, you know, in a sense, the most extraordinary thing is the fact that this strike kept going for a whole year.
One of the things that, you know, in the intervening four decades, you've read, you know, we've read memoirs and, you know, stories of people who grew up in miners and former miner families, those communities, and the degree to which, if you didn't live there and didn't experience it, you don't fully know what it meant to those places. And you know, every anniversary, other, you know, a new piece will come up. Someone will be talking about their dad or their mother or you know, their local community and how it was changed and devastated by the effects of the strike. When you do this oral history project yourself and you're speaking to these communities, what surprised you when you were speaking to them?
There's a lot of deprivation in these communities. That you can see, they're run down, you know, shops are shut and so on. And you hear stories about, you know, swimming pools that have shut and cinemas and people moving away for work and people doing work that now that it's much, you know, that's unskilled. They're working for the council or working in factories or they're doing deliveries or they're working in warehouses. I suppose two things that impressed me. First of all, the resilience of these people. Extraordinarily resilient, and particularly the women. I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that sometimes if you're interviewing an ex-miner and his wife, the person who dominates the room is the wife. And very often the man, you know, the man has been broken in many ways, but the women came into their own during the strike through organization, through public speaking, through fundraising, through basically coming in out of the kitchen and into the public sphere. And many of those people went on, you know, when they returned to college or they went to college, they qualified as, you know, probation officers and social workers, particularly the women. So in a sense, the women came out of the strike, but better than the men in many ways. But the other thing that strikes me is that there's a huge amount of activity in these communities, particularly in South Wales and County Durham and Scotland. A lot of people have thrown their weight into local community activities, fundraising, what I call community-facing professions. So, for example, in Scotland, there are a lot of ex-miners who have gone into the care profession, working in children's hospices or old people's homes or with the homeless. They've been trying to repair their own communities, you know, given the fact that they were kind of more or less abandoned by the government. And I'll give you another example in Nottinghamshire. Nottinghamshire is one of those places where there's been a sort of heroin epidemic. And again, there's a miner's wife there who became a local councillor and worked with the local MP, who was John Mann, you know, in order to try and confront, you know, this heroin scourge in their community. So I think the resilience and then the giving back to their community through their own resources and their own organisations, because these people still feel abandoned by the government. And if you look at the kind of, you know, there have been recent articles about levelling up and how levelling up hasn't really worked. And it hasn't really worked in a top-down way, but in a bottom-up way, these people are doing what they can to repair their own communities.
I mean, finally, we're kind of looking back at this sort of distance of 40 years, but obviously it's a deeper dispute. It goes back into the 70s, as you described, and beyond into the deep binding of a huge coal industry into the British politics of the 20th century. What for you is the major misconception about the strike? Because I'm sure, as I've been reiterating my memories from when I was a teenager, I'm sure you've been going, well, that's wrong and that's wrong and that's wrong. What for you are the biggest misconceptions about this huge event?
Well, I think one misconception that we have now is that, as you say, people can't understand why people should have been involved in this industry that was dirty and dangerous and polluting. But I suppose there was a whole tradition of mining was handed down from father to son, and many fathers didn't want their sons to go down the pits because it was dangerous. Hmm. And you know, the stories of miners being killed or injured or suffering terrible, you know, lung diseases, I mean, you know, are very true. But there was a pride. I think there was a pride about the mine. It was a very masculine job. It was a very tough job, and I think and it did produce the pride of a profession, the pride of a working class, the pride of a community. And that pride in a job well done and a job done by skilled working people, you know, was something that was swept away, and it was a tremendous blow to masculine pride. I think the long history of coal mining, and if you like, the nobility of coal mining and the solidarity that existed in mining communities is something that we need to think about. But also, I think on the plus side, in many of those communities now, that solidarity has disappeared. But I have been going to a number of events celebrating the 40th anniversary, particularly in South Wales, County Durham, and in Scotland, also in Yorkshire, and the pride in what they achieved, the memories that they have, the heritage that they're seeking to cultivate. They are very keen that this story should be, you know, should be conveyed to their children and grandchildren, so that the story of their work and the story of their struggle should not be forgotten.
Robert Kildare, thank you very much for joining us at the Bunker and revisiting that fascinating story, which is on such a scale, I sometimes find it hard to believe that it happened at all. But it was a fascinating conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, we hope you found this episode illuminating. If so, then we should mention that The Bunker could really use your support via Patreon. There's not as much advertising around in the podcasting industry as there was, so we need your help to keep us providing your daily morning listen. As little as £3 a month plus VAT will help us pay panellists and producers, keep the lights on and pay the rent. So search Patreon Bunker Podcast or follow the link in the show notes to find out how you can help. Your support will be truly appreciated and we won't have to get Paul Weller to do a benefit record for us. If you like this episode, you might also enjoy an episode of our companion podcast, Jam Tomorrow, on the coal industry. It's available right now, and we'll put a link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
The Bunker was written and presented by Podmasters group editor, Andrew Harrison. The producer was Eliza Davis-Beard. The audio producer was me, Jade Bailey, and the managing editor was Jacob Jarvis. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.